It's very, very good to be back, let me tell you. For those of you who have dreamt of travel and of seeing faraway places and lots of them, I can tell you it can be a little bit overrated. Getting there is wonderful, but all of the in-between, which actually involves the planes, the travel, the continually being treated like a criminal at every airport that you go into, it can be a little overrated. But I just got back a couple of days ago from Brazil, which was quite an interesting trip. I had never been to a couple of cities there. And they have some very, very involved people who are very, very much committed to this theosophical movement and the ideas that it's brought forward. So it's something that was very good to connect with all of those folks. Tonight I wanted to talk about something, and you know, overcoming fear. I think probably what we'll do is we'll kind of sneak up on the topic, but overcoming fear, largely because that seems to be such a predominating emotion in the world today. Something that kind of moves the way that we respond. And so I think it's something that perhaps we need to consider, because obviously, if we're not willing to take a look at it, then we kind of fall prey to being unconscious in our activities. So just to give it some consideration, I think would be worthwhile. So first of all, one of the things that is a core concept in these ageless wisdom tradition teachings, there's a central idea that's very fundamental for all of us to grasp from the outset. And it's an idea that's expressed in different ways, but probably we can understand it as the idea of the multidimensional nature of ourselves as human beings and the multidimensional nature of the universe within which we live. So, you know, just to make it clear, it's something that we all get, but sometimes, you know, you use more than three syllable words and it can confuse me, you know, multidimensionality. What are we talking about? It's a basic idea. And it's the idea that we experience from day to day, that we function at many different levels. We're aware of it in fairly obvious ways. Everybody is aware of what it happens within the physical body. We have these sensations. You know, so we have the pain, we have the sight, we have different sensations that influence the physical aspect. So, you know, this is one dimension. The one probably somehow I can't say we're most familiar with, but it's one of the most familiar for us. We also are very much aware that from moment to moment, whether we pay attention to it or not, we're being influenced by this whole world of feelings or emotions. You know, we know when something that is like anger or happiness or sadness is occurring within us, if we give it a little bit of attention. So, you know, we function at the physical level, we function at an emotional level. We also are quite aware that we are, you know, one of the distinguishing features of being a human being is that we have this capacity for thought. So we can think thoughts that are free from sensations, that are beyond even the reach of emotion. And so that these are levels that, you know, just day to day we find ourselves functioning on. I mean, is that something that seems to be the normal experience? So, you know, multidimensional is obvious to us along these certain lines. What the ageless wisdom tradition would speak about is that there are, in fact, dimensions that exceed these, on which we are also functioning, but largely unconsciously. So this is the nature of the human being, and it's the nature of the universe within which we live, that it is also multidimensional. All of these ranges, spectrum of consciousness, exist throughout the universe and exist within us. So at any given moment, we can find ourselves centered, our awareness centered, at any one of these levels. And what we find is that from time to time, we find ourselves feeling influenced by something that is quite lofty. And that's what we tend to identify as this. Oftentimes people use the word a spiritual center or a higher self. I think I've said this before, but one of the things that I find myself leaning more and more toward is moving away from certain language that seems to be a little bit limiting for many people. The language that I would customarily have used would be to talk in terms of spirituality and that which is spiritual. And it's perfectly valid way of expressing, but it's only a valid way of expressing so long as you're in the presence of people who grasp it in the way that you intend it. Very often when we start to speak of the spiritual, for many people, it goes straight to religion that you're talking about. You know, so when you're talking about spirituality, it is as if only the religious community has the corner on the market for that way of speech. So it, you know, without knowing what it is you're necessarily talking about, it goes into this realm of, oh, he's talking about some religion or other. Which, you know, spirituality obviously is something that applies profoundly in the religious world when that's the understanding that's coming from religion. Often it's not. But probably the word that I find myself tending more toward these days is speaking in terms of consciousness. Consciousness is one of those words that in many ways is the equivalent to what we understand as spiritual. It is all-pervading. Its range is limitless. It's something that expresses itself in the human dimension, the mineral dimension, the divine. So, you know, consciousness is one of those things that for many people, you can have a discussion based on that because it's sort of undeniable. You know, whether or not it can yet be tested scientifically or not, it's something that it would be hard for anyone to say, well, I don't have any consciousness. You know, that would be a tough argument to make just by virtue of the fact that they're speaking. There must be something happening behind those eyes. So anyway, this consciousness that we find expressing in different ways can express at this very profound level. And when we find ourselves actually accessing this dimension of our being, it has a certain way that it tends to express. So we find it being at least perceived by others as expressions of love or of compassion, or they'll describe it as something related to wisdom. When we're operating from this deeper dimension of our being, the difficulty for us is that it's seldom that we do. And you know, the access that we allow ourselves, that we afford ourselves, is the challenge. There's a beautiful portion of a poem by Alfred Lord Tennyson. Speaks about this. He says, "Speak to him, for he listens." Talking about the higher self. "Speak to him, for he listens, and for spirit with spirit can meet. Closer is he than breathing, and nearer than hands and feet." I always love that one. I mean, the reason being that it says the proximity of this depth of our being that somehow or another we only touch on occasionally. The problem for us, a problem arises because this deeper consciousness is somehow the experience of everyone. Everyone has touched on this. Everyone has had certainly moments when something has expressed through them that has made them know of this profound and abiding connection. And then somehow it gets lost. And then also, when we operate from the memory of this experience, it creates problems because we look around us and you see that, you know, billions of people in this world, just like us, and yet the behavior doesn't match the experience of this higher consciousness, and even our own behavior. I mean, we find ourselves continually contradicting the highest and deepest things that we know. So it gets to be something of a problem for us. One of the founders of the Theosophical Society, H.P. Blavatsky, she said something that I think applies to this. What she said was this, that whatever plane of consciousness we are acting in, for that time, we and the things of that plane are the only realities. I'll say it again, because it might, she wasn't one who was fond of the simple phrase. And also, this is something that I think has some importance. Whatever plane of consciousness we are acting in, both we and the things of that plane are, for the time being, the only realities. So just to break it down a little bit, you take the example of a fish living in water. That fish lives in a certain medium, operates within a certain medium, and has no awareness of us sitting here in this room, of birds flying up above it. It's aware of the things of its plane of consciousness, we could say. They even say that someone who is a thief, you know, that their mind is tuned on how to pick your pocket or take what you have. They say that a thief can look at a holy man and all he'll see is his wallet and a plan on how to get it. So the plane of consciousness affects the reality of what we see. They say to a liar, the whole world is dishonest. Even though even a liar wants you to tell him the truth. It's just the way it is. And to a saint, they say to a saint, whether it's a criminal, a businessman, whatever the person is, poor person, dying person, they see the holiest of holy in that person. Mother Teresa, the thing she always said was that when she was picking up all these people who were the poorest of the poor, the most destitute, the dying, and carrying them back to be tended to, she said that whenever she looked at them, what she saw was the baby Jesus looking back at her. That was her response. So we have this capacity. We only see what it is that is consistent with the place where our consciousness is centered. So this is an important thing to remember. So let's talk a little bit about fear. Sophocles, yet another wise man. One of the things that I benefit from when I'm speaking is that I have the ability to remember things that great people said. And it certainly makes me look good. I mean, it's like, you may forget about Sophocles and say, Tim Boyd said. I frequently find myself quoting Einstein, you know. Because, you know, if you're starting to look a little bit dumb or a little bit rough around the edges, quote Einstein. And your stock goes up immediately. But no, Sophocles. One of the things he said about fear, he said, to the man, and this applies equally to all people, but to the man who is in fear, everything rustles. You get that? Everything rustles. You know, and you can imagine where he was coming from. you know, you take the example of something fear. You're afraid that something's happening. You're walking down a dark street in a neighborhood you don't know. You know, maybe there's a little bit of thunder or lightning in the background. And you're very hyper alert. And so in that state, and we've all been in this state at different times, everything is making sounds. You know, the things that you would never even know, the piece of paper blowing down the street is some sort of harbinger of danger. So to the man who is in fear, everything rustles. So one of the difficulties with this emotional state that's described as fear, some people would say that there are a total of four emotions. Happiness, sadness, anger, and fear. And that everything else is just kind of a mixture or an accentuation or diminished state of these four basic emotions. But fear is one of those ones that, you know, however we tend to look at it, it's something that touches every single person, not just one time in our lives or at times in our lives. It's one of those things that we have to come up with an idea of what it is in order that we can adjust ourselves to the demands that it places upon us. And fears run the gamut. I mean, I know people who, if I were to sit here and start even talking about snakes, spiders, cockroaches, you know, they would feel uncomfortable. And if I stayed on the subject long enough, they'd get up and go. And everybody has some little thing that, you know, has that sort of effect. But this list can be very, very long. The problem with this mind of fear is that genuine fears are, it's sort of an evolutionary quality, that there are things that evolved so that we would be afraid and it would condition us to save ourselves and perpetuate the species. But a lot of those things have disappeared in our age. You know, there are no dinosaurs or saber-toothed tigers running around, running down people. But we transfer this same sort of emotional state onto so many things that we find in our normal environment today. And the other problem with it is that we have fear is something that is experienced in the moment. Something fearful arises, the emotion arises, and then the emotion settles down when the fearful influence departs. But we have this capacity, because of the development of our own minds, of taking these fears and projecting them into the future. So many people go through life fearing something that is yet to come. Oftentimes fearing something that never will come, it never has happened, and it never will. But they're afraid. I had a neighbor. This was back when you used to actually have neighborhoods in Chicago. And it used to be that in the evening time, after get done working and everything, you'd sit out on your front porch. I don't know if any of you are even old enough to remember that sort of thing. Maybe so. Actually, I'm not the only one who's gray here. Or bald. Not to interrupt your meditation, John. But yeah, it used to be you'd go out in the evening and you'd sit on your front porch and you'd talk across the porch. And so I had a neighbor, and her name, we called her Miss Bob. I mean, her actual name was Miss Ida Van Eden, but she was from down south, and the way it worked there, her husband's name was Bob Van Eden, so everybody just called her Miss Bob. You know, I'm not from the south, so I don't get all the traditions, but I called her Miss Bob. And, you know, we'd talk across the porch. Came a time when I'd come out on the front porch and Miss Bob wouldn't be there. You know, and this went on for a while. And then I, you know, go next door and knock on her door. Oh, come on in, Tim. And we start talking. And it got to the point that the conversation went like this. Anytime I'd go and knock on her door. Say, hey, Miss Bob, how you doing? Oh, good, good. Come on in, Tim. Did you hear about that boy that got shot? I said, no. You didn't see the news? And then you come back another day. Did you hear about that virus that's spreading? Didn't you watch the news? But it's, she never got a virus. She never got shot. You know, none of the things that she saw on TV ever affected her. But she lived the latter part of her life in this perpetual state of fear engendered by, you know, the marketing of fear that takes place. So we have this capacity to be able to project into the future situations that might arise from our past. And this is the way many of us live from moment to moment. Oftentimes, it is the case that whatever conditions we experienced in early childhood have a way of being imprinted so profoundly that that becomes something of an identity that we operate from. And so you have places, you have people where if they're in the presence of somebody who talks loudly, it reminds them of their home, where when the voice is raised, soon there was going to be some sort of violent episode. And so the fear of loud voices is something that has been instilled in the person. And many other sorts of conditions. All of us have had some sort of imprinting. So these are the sorts of things that we find ourselves having to deal with from time to time. But we don't deal with it because generally we're unaware. We'll talk a little bit about that. But one of the things that we find with strong emotions is that they don't stay localized on just one plane. So, you know, we talked about physical, emotional, mental. Something like fear or that level of strong emotion reaches up and affects our thinking, and it also reaches down into our physiology. So the actual way in which fear is described from a physiological point of view, they say that when there is the response of fear, what sets in is this condition that is described as fight or flight. That the body prepares itself for one or the other. And this goes back to the time when, you know, we were running away from saber-toothed tigers. You know, that either we're going to have to stand our ground and fight for our survival, or we will make the choice to hightail it out of there and live to fight another day. One of the two. And to the body, it makes no difference because both of them are going to require an increase in the stores of energy. So what happens with the body, you know, and you just think about any fearful moment you've had. The heart rate accelerates. The breathing accelerates. The muscle tension increases because you're ready to spring in one direction or another. The blood sugar level goes up, because you're going to need stores of energy for any one of these responses. And internally, there is this hormonal bath that is going on. Adrenaline is being released. Epinephrine is being released. Cortisol is being released. And so the body just suddenly gears up. And it has to be very quick. So it's a stressful response on the body. And this is, you know, this is what happens every time. So for the person who, you know, maintains this constant sort of awareness of fearful things, it's one of those things that has profound physiological consequences. And so it's something that it would be well for us to get a handle on and perhaps learn how to deal with. One of the other aspects, you know, we talk about the physical aspect, Obviously, from the ageless wisdom perspective, physical is one of the least, not least important, because it catches our attention first. But it's one of the lesser in terms of its scope of its reach. Fear also has another quality to it, that it can, in fact, be contagious. It's something that can spread from one person to another, just like any strong emotion or strong thought spreads. I had the experience when I was 19 years old of being in a crowd that suddenly became overwhelmed by this sudden wave of fear. And it's not a pretty thing at all. You know, to think that I don't have an attraction to large crowds to this day, because, you know, the way I witnessed it was a few people suddenly became fearful of something. They weren't quite sure what it was, but it was enough to make them feel like, we're not going to fight, we're going to flight, you know? So they started running, and their fear set everyone around them into motion, and so it set off a stampede where 1,000 people, not one of them knowing what they were running from, suddenly started to run, and whatever got in their path got trampled. So it has a contagious quality, because, you know, one of the truths when we talk about multidimensionality is that we share these fields of consciousness within which we operate. I mean, everybody has had the experience of not touching, not even having to look at, but sitting in the presence of someone who is depressed, for example. And if you sit there long enough, without saying a word, without interacting, you will walk away feeling depleted, unless you're very conscious and unless you take certain steps to prevent it. Similarly, we've had the experience of sitting in the presence of people who are filled with life, who are exuberant, who are in vital, and nothing even needs to be said. We walk away feeling charged and say, that's a person I want to hang out with. We know that. We don't need any profound, you know, it doesn't take a deep scientific explanation for all of this. There is a mental field, there is an emotional field that we all share, and we're constantly pouring our current into that. So this is the fact that we can recognize, but from that, you also have to recognize, for one thing, it bears some certain responsibility to us for our part, you know, whether we muddy the waters or whether we are agent in clearing them. But in another sense, it just explains this whole idea of contagions, mental contagions, emotional contagions. There have been situations in the recent history of humanity where whole nations have been engulfed in some sort of mental contagion that has turned neighbor against neighbor in the most vicious sorts of ways. You know, people who are, you would have regarded as good people. You know, folks like you and me, who under the influence of, under the unaware influence of these strong mental currents have behaved in ways that would be abhorrent to them, looking back. So this is this shared environment within which we all live and move at every given moment. So, you know, that's one of the facts. Just to up my stock a little bit more, Aristotle once said. Another problem with this whole fear thing, to the extent that it remains something that we are unaware of, the quote from Aristotle applies that what you fear, you will hate. What you fear, you will hate. You know, the emotional spectrum degenerates. And so the things that you fear, it's just a small step away to that becoming a thing that you actively wish that its existence would cease. You know, if someone's afraid of a snake, see the snake, it's not pick the snake up and carry it to a more comfortable place for the snake. It's like grab a hoe, grab a nut, do something, kill that snake. And, you know, we needless to say, we have seen how it can escalate to personifications of people, groups of people. What you fear, you will hate. And so it's very important that at some level we learn to, first of all, come to recognize and then develop means to actually deal with it. And we're going to talk a little bit about that. While we're talking about this whole fear subject, we've talked about the lowest expressions. In the spiritual traditions of the world, there are references made to the same word, fear, but something that has a profoundly different meaning. In the Bible, for instance, you have this phrase, and it comes up a couple of times, that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. That's not, you know, you're talking about a different sort of fear there. The fear of the Almighty, the fear of the divine, is the beginning of wisdom. How does that work? Now, if you translate it as this base sort of fear that has you wanting to fight it or run from it, well, then you miss the point completely, because there is no beginning to wisdom in that sort of fear. But the fear, I think, needs to be differently translated. I had an experience a number of years ago. I was somewhere, and it was, you know, at that particular moment, I found myself in some sort of elevated state of mind. And I went, it was late at night, and I went down to take a walk by the ocean side. And it was a night when the ocean was really surging. It wasn't a calm night for the ocean that night. And I found myself just standing in the presence of this limitless body of water. And just, you know, in that moment, I found myself kind of just feeling my way into this surging life of the. But a certain point came where the only way I could describe it was some little sense of fear arose. It wasn't like I was going to run away, but it was something more related to a profound awe. I felt completely in awe of the vastness and of the insignificance of myself as this, as an individual, in the face of this limitless body, you know, this life-giving ocean. So I think the fear of the Lord, in this sense, speaks of a profound recognition, first of all, of the smallness of our isolated selves, but also of the vastness of this larger body of which we are a part. It can perhaps be something of a fearful experience for us to recognize that our potentials are without limit. That's very challenging to, you know, the identities that we have become so familiar with. So that sort of fear is a very different thing. There's a passage, actually it's one of my favorite passages in the Bhagavad Gita, you know, the song of Krishna, the Lord's song, they call it. And for those of you who are, most of you are probably familiar with it, but for those of you who are not, the Gita is the book that really was the basis of Gandhi's spirituality. He was actually introduced to it, by the way, through two theosophists, two members of the Theosophical Society in London. Gandhi was not deeply versed in the spirituality of India for a good deal of his life. But it's a book that tells about a dialogue between Arjuna and Krishna, Krishna being the embodiment of the divine. But at one point, during this dialogue, Arjuna asks Krishna. He realizes that Krishna is not just the guy who's driving his chariot. He was the charioteer for Arjuna. But he realizes that, in fact, this is the embodiment of divinity itself that he is having this conversation with. And at a certain point, he says, look, could you do this for me? You know, I know you're here. You sort of confined yourself to this human-looking form. Show me your real form. And, you know, Krishna responds, well, you know, you have, because we're having this conversation, you know, I don't do this for everybody. Actually, he said, I've never done it for anybody. He says, but, you know, whatever the reason, your karma justifies it. So here it is. And then the way the passage goes, Arjuna now sees Krishna in his real form. And he says what he saw, he said that he had eyes that looked in all directions, that he had mouths on all sides, and that every living thing was flying into his mouth to be consumed. He said that his brightness was so bright that he was burning up universes. I mean, this is the stuff that Hollywood wished it could get onto. But you know, brightness so bright, universes were being scorched and burned. And he said, after he saw this, his hair stood on end, and he started to plead with Krishna. Please, you know, enough is enough. You know, could you do this for me? Return to your other form, please, because I can't take it. But the term that was used for Arjuna's response to this vision was the term fear. But that's not fear. The awe that comes with the perception of reality is something that has an effect on us. And, you know, this is this higher description of fear. All right. So having said all this, great description of fear, all that, higher possibilities, good, good. Now what can we do? I don't know. No, I'm kidding. No. Good night. No. It's one thing that has been described as the actual root of all fears. There's a term that has been used that is described as the heresy of separateness, which is to say we have this profound conviction that on some very deep and fundamental level, each one of us is an isolated and separate entity operating independently of all others. You know, and even though we may have heard teachings about interdependence and given some thought to this idea of oneness, our day-to-day reality convinces us every time I get up in the morning and I have to put on my shirt, the fact I'm putting on my shirt and it doesn't put anybody else's shirt on them, well, we must be separate. Or, you know, if I feed myself and, you know, my belly gets full but nobody else's does, well, this is further proof we are separate. So there is this conviction that somehow or another we are separated from one another, that we live on, that we thrive on, that defines our reality, that is described as a heresy. It's utterly incorrect. So, you know, what to do? If we were to go to a doctor with a condition, if he was a good doctor, the first thing that he would do would be to examine us. And after doing an examination, he would diagnose, put a name to it, you know, point to it, say, this is what the problem is. Having done that, then he would prescribe. So the prescription, you know, for a doctor, he'd give you some pills. You wouldn't feel satisfied if he didn't, you know, so he'll give you some pills. And then, if he's a good doctor, he would also tell you about perhaps things you need to change in your diet. He might also tell you about lifestyle changes. Get some more sleep. He might tell you you need to do more exercise than you're doing, and of a particular type. And if he was a doctor who was really sort of an elevated-minded sort of doctor, he also would tell you things that you need to do related to your thinking. You know, so books you might want to read, meditation you might want to try, prayer, something like that. But it would be something that would be a multi-layered approach. And that's a good way to approach it. So, you know, just in terms of a basic sort of approach, the very first thing that is required in any of this, the African saying, and I may have even shared this before, the disease that is hidden cannot be cured. If it's hidden away, you can't cure it. It will continue its activity in the darkness, and ultimately it will win. So the disease that's hidden can't be cured. So it begins with, everything begins with awareness, recognition, pointing, naming. You know, this is a fear that I have. It begins with that. And that sometimes is the most difficult, because oftentimes we have functioned for a lifetime in denial. That, you know, it's people who are making me angry, that it's various, you know, it's the weather that causes me to, you know, close in. Point to it and name it is where it begins. And then other options become available. Sometimes just in that process, a healing occurs, because it's the first time something has come to light. And oftentimes when something comes to light, it has a way of dissipating. It's not the big bad boogeyman that we thought it was. But then sometimes it actually is. You know, it's something that has been controlling us for so long. So another option we can have is there is a creative use of imagination that is possible. You know, we can actually walk ourselves through these various fearful sorts of situations with the imagination of the opposite of fear. You know, so if it is a snake or a spider or a bully or a bad parent that has gotten into us in this terms of fear, we can walk ourselves through being before that situation. I mean, it's a safe way because we control it in our imagination. You know, we find ourselves in the presence of. We walk through it. We feel the fear arise. We recognize the fear. We say that this is something I am in control of at this point. And we face the person in our own minds, in the settings that we choose. And we allow this fear to come up to awareness. And we watch it also as it dissipates under our control. And so this is something where oftentimes, through the repetition of such an imagination, the force of this hidden emotion becomes dissipated. It dissipates through recognition and through the controlled, under our control, bringing it to the surface and then allowing it to recede. But always under your watchful eye, because you have seen it, you have named it, you have called it out on your terms. So that's one approach. Oftentimes, one of the best things that we can do when there is something that has this sort of power over us is what you might call strategic avoidance. You know, it's not, there's nothing wrong with not placing yourself in the presence of abusive situations or abusive people or people who have been in that role. Nothing wrong with that at all. Even if it's, you know, someone that you're supposed to be dearly loving, you know, your mother, your father, that's not a bad choice. So these are, you know, these are different ways. I also want to share with you one thing that is, there is this idea that, you know, if we're doing multiple levels of approach to a thing, that the highest level of the highest level includes all of the lower levels. So the deepest, most profound level of healing also encompasses all of the others. So if you wanted to go toward the root, that's something that you can also, we can also approach. So the root, if we take the root as being true, that the reason why there is even the possibility of a fear is because we have this conviction that somehow we are isolated and separate, which makes sense, in the sense that the only justification for fear is that somehow this isolated self can be harmed. This isolated self is somehow vulnerable. You know, it can be destroyed. It will die. You know, all of the various things that we associate with this, what we know to be temporary personality. It's only here for 70, 80 years, 90, 100 at the most. So this conviction of separateness, if we actually point our efforts toward relaxing that some, that can perhaps have the greatest effect. There was something I had thought to describe to you. I'll give you a portion of it because I want to respect your time and mine as well. And I find that once I get going, it can go. So I'll just refer you to it. There is something H.P. Blavatsky, who was the founder, one of the principal founders of the Theosophical Society, very wise woman, very in touch with profound levels of spirituality. She talked an awful lot about meditation and its value. Almost nowhere did she actually give any specifics about, you know, how you might meditate. But she did dictate a diagram of meditation 3 years before she died. 3 years or 7 years before she died. It's called the H.P. Blavatsky's Diagram of Meditation. You know how Google works. I don't need to tell you. But there is a central idea. There are some other ideas that can be a little bit more demanding. But it begins with this idea that the first thing we must do as part of this meditative practice and as part of building a healthy overall life, inwardly and outwardly, first, try to conceive of unity. Try to conceive of unity. Yeah, so what does unity even mean? You know, it's a word, but it's one of those words that is so vast, so all-encompassing, that to even think of putting it into a conception is, you're not going to be able to do it no matter what, but you're supposed to try to conceive of unity. And then she gives a suggestion of how. By expansion in space and infinite in time. So, you know, space is one of those things that no matter how you look at it, no matter what your philosophical background, space is necessarily something that is eternal, that is necessarily without limits, without bounds. I mean, where does space end? You know, how does space cease to exist? Because, you know, time has run out on it? No. So space, try to conceive of unity, and the approach she recommends is by expansion in space, in our awareness. So we extend, we extend, we extend, which necessarily has an impact. Because the sense of limitation, the sense of isolation that this sort of meditation works against is something that necessarily it dissipates with this attempt at expansion. And so, and then infinite in time. there are other aspects. I had hoped perhaps to address some of those. But if this is all you do, I mean, if only you give some consideration to what unity might mean, and then you also can place yourself within this sort of whatever conception you arrive at of what this unity means, you will necessarily find yourself within it. And so this is something that has this effect of working on this heresy of separateness. It starts to loosen. And as it loosens, one of the effects of it is necessarily the promotion of a sense of courage. You know, that the things that might have once caused us dread don't have the same impact, because what we regard as the self that was threatened has expanded. And so these are just some suggestions. And I think it's important mainly because something has to be done to stem this rising tide that can and does seem to engulf so many in the world today. We're living at a time when, you know, a global level of fear is, it probably wasn't possible for this sort of thing to exist previous to the sort of interconnections that we have through the internet and other things. So, you know, now I just went to Brazil and I was being advised that maybe the trip should be canceled. Why? Because the news, Zika, virus, you know, the next baby that comes in my family might have a small head. That was the effect of the virus that was being promoted. Obviously, a little bit more research, and you find that the story's a little bit weak, but fear is what it engenders. So, and this is the possibility. A mosquito bites someone in Brazil, and trip is canceled in America, and tourism ceases to a country, and economies collapse, and, you know, this is the world that we're living in. So our participation in this way that this functions is something that, if we're unaware, we have no choice. We're swept along just like everybody else. But to the extent that you actually make the choice not to be aware of the news of the day, that's fine, but to be aware of the news of your own inner state, then you exercise a life responsibly. And I think that's the important thing. That first of all, that we have the capacity to do it, and second, that we do it. So toward that end, that's really what I wanted to talk about this evening.
If a person whom you love unjustifiably fears you and therefore wants to end the relationship, how do you overcome their fears?
How do you overcome their fear?
That's what the question said.
So it sounds as if you would like the relationship to continue. I don't know that you can overcome somebody else's fears. Perhaps the best thing that one could do toward that end would be to examine oneself and see if honestly there is something there that is worthy of producing fear in another. All of us respond to things very differently, and very often it's not necessarily, doesn't have anything to do with anything that someone has done specifically, but it could be related to a perception of what could be done. Very often people find themselves in relationships and, you know, they have a fear of being hurt. And so to avoid the possibility of being hurt, it's better to end the relationship. And that's, you know, that's one person's solution. But you know, everybody has to work on their own level, and I do not believe that it is within someone's power to overcome the conditioning of someone else. The best that you can do is to, as profoundly as you can, understand your own conditioning, and then from that, perhaps you would lose the need to feel that you need to exert control over somebody else in terms of how they respond to you, and then, who knows, they might find you're all the more attractive.
Thank you very much for this lecture. My question is, you mentioned the marketing of fear and how some would have us be fearful of things that it's not useful for us to be fearful about if we have information and perspective. But there are things that threaten us. And ultimately, no matter what we do, we will lose everything that we have and everyone who we love, and we'll cease to exist. And I'm wondering what utility or futility fear has in that larger regard, and what perspective is helpful and wholesome when considering those mm-hmm. kinds of things.
Yeah. Probably most of what I was talking about has to do with the non-useful aspects of fear. Because obviously, you know, if something is running after you to get you, you would be foolish not to draw upon the energy that this kind of evolutionary type of fear would give you. Everybody is going to come here. Everybody's going to leave. Everybody that we know is going to, everybody that we love is going to slip away from us if we don't slip away first. So those are things that we know are true. But the recognition of that need not be something that is fear-based. These things are facts. And to the extent that we can recognize it as the nature of living, then perhaps it's not quite so fearful. One of the beauties of the ageless wisdom sorts of teachings that theosophy embodies is that it also provides for a possibility of another level of understanding as well. So everybody will certainly die and leave, which is to say, not to say that they will cease to exist. That if everybody is ending and ceases to exist, that could be a problem. Then that's sort of a pointless environment that we're living in. But the idea that is put forward is that basically everybody, with or without a body, the consciousness continues to exist. And from the theosophical perspective, the taking on of a body is sort of a cyclical process that has occurred before, will occur again. And so based on that, you have the idea that many people who are meeting in this life have been together in previous situations. It's not to say that every time we come back we're with the same group of people, but we have long-term affiliations with groups of people. And so it's one of those things where nothing really ends in that sense, but it just takes on a different form temporarily. So that's kind of awareness that if it's something that appeals to you, if it's something that you can reason your way through and make sense out of, that has a certain power in how we approach how fearful we become about losing all of the things that we have. We will lose it. Necessarily, that's a painful process. I mean, I remember Yogananda, the autobiography of a yogi, he was a very elevated man. He wrote about when his teacher died, his beloved teacher. And Yogananda's response was he just was wailing uncontrollably, just wailing at the loss of this beloved person to him, even though he had this profound awareness and this profound connection, even after the body had gone. But it severely alters the type of connection that we have, of course. But again, it's something that it doesn't necessarily alleviate the pain, but it puts it into a different perspective. So in that sense, knowledge is powerful.
Tim, I read something where a person's thoughts, they sometimes aren't based in truth. And, you know, I thought about that, and I said, maybe somebody else's thoughts aren't based in truth, but I know mine are. But then I was on an airplane once, and I was flying, and all of a sudden I started getting like a little panic attack. And I go, what the heck is going on here? And so I was thinking about it, and all of a sudden I just said, stop. And it stopped, and I go, how did I do that? But my mind created it, and with the awareness you were talking about, my mind stopped it, and it was so simple.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very good example. The key, I mean, as Augie was saying, the key to all of this, actually the key to everything, is awareness. If we're not aware, you have no capacity to influence it. It's just happening, and you're not even involved in it. You're just being pushed like the leaf in the wind. But with awareness, you can exercise multiple levels of choice. You can bring to bear resources that are yours to use that you couldn't otherwise. So awareness is always, it's always the key. I mean, simple sort of thing with meditation even. A lot of people would like to meditate, but they can't figure out how to do it. There's so many complicated formulas, and, you know, I can't twist my legs into a pretzel, so I can't meditate. But just the simple awareness of the breath is the most basic kind of, it can be the fullest, most profound sort of meditation. It sounds like it's, you know, it's too simple to be true. But try sitting and just becoming aware of the breath as it flows in. I mean, even feel it on your upper lip. You know, it's cool when it's coming in, it's warm when it's coming out. And just focus on that for 10 minutes. And you will find that it will move you to deeper and deeper. You'll become aware of other things that are happening. I mean, maybe you weren't aware that there was a pulse that's happening inside the body. And you'll suddenly be quiet enough that you'll feel that, hey, you know, there's something flowing in my body. You can feel nerve currents. And then you start to become aware that you're much more than you thought you were before. And as this process continues, you start to become quite aware that the boundaries for who you are do not end at your skin. That on some very deep level, we are connected with something we could best describe as a greater life. We live and move inside of it. It lives and moves through us. And then the sense of isolation also diminishes. It's the same process however we go at it. That the process of becoming wise is this process of becoming unselfed. That we no longer feel so bound and linked and shackled by this identity that we have cultivated and clung to and fought for. If we can release that even a little and utilize some of this basic kind of methods for doing that, whether it's prayer, whether it's meditation, you will find that there will be results. And then nobody has to, you don't have to come to a lecture, because you know yourself, you know. You'll be telling others. And it really, you know, the reason why I think this sort of thing is so well hidden is because it is so simple. It is so simple. But simple doesn't mean easy. And it doesn't mean immediate, but it sure is simple.
Hi, Tim. Thank you so much for your talk. I remember one time I was going through a really difficult time, and I was very fearful, and somebody explained to me this, the acronyms for FEAR, which was false expectations appearing real. And when I just meditated on that and thought about the truth of that, because what you said about, you know, that projection into the future, and how much time we waste worrying with fear, it really is, you know, it just zaps all your energy. And so if you can stop yourself from that fear and worry of the future, which nobody knows and has control over anyway, and then, you know, I call it pulling myself back off the edge and trying to stay in reality with what's right in front of me right now, you know, I can dissipate that fear because it's not something that's immediate, and just take it minute by minute, hour by hour, or day by day. And it's a way that I'm able to, I don't know if you want to call it, manage it, or, you know, look at it for what it really is. And again, holding it up to really, you know, look at it and say, what is it I'm fearing, and how real is it, or what's the lie that's telling me that?
Right.
So you have to examine it. So that's that responsibility, I think. So it's very interesting. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, this is a good case example of just how exactly one can approach it. Yeah. Call it to awareness. Point at it and see what's real and what isn't. And it, what if it's not real, it falls away. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
Going back to the previous point about the self and how we cling to our self, even though it's opposite to the reality of oneness. Most things in nature seem to have a logical reason. So a fever burns off a disease, and fear gives us the fight or flight. So I see a logical reason for most things in every part of the universe. But why do we have that feeling of self? I don't understand where that came from, because it really doesn't serve any purpose at all. And it's something that we really have to overcome. Is there, what's the benefit of the fact that we even feel that way?
Sure, sure, yeah. You like big questions. But I mean, big question and good question, really. One of the ideas that you find in the teachings, theosophical teachings, is that everywhere we look, just like you say, nature, everywhere you look, there are cycles that we can witness. So, I mean, the obvious ones are day and night, you know, the earth circles around the sun. But there are also larger cycles. And there are cycles that involve, you know, each human life. One of the things that is described as one of these more grand cycles is what's described as the obligatory pilgrimage of the soul, which is to say the spiritual essence of the individual. It has its home in this state of, you could say, undivided oneness. But that this pilgrimage begins, and it finds itself descending, you could say, to where, you know, we speak about ourselves very often as body, mind, spirit. That's one of the familiar delineations. So spirit associates itself with mind, associates itself with the physical body. And so what we find is you have a spiritual dimension that is experiencing the world in the only way that it can, through the elements of that world. So out of that, we build what we call a self. The false self is the self where we find ourselves embracing everything except the spiritual essence. So a point comes in this cycle where there is this complete descent, where you have the highest spirit living through the lowest matter. It's depicted in the religious mythologies of the world. So, for instance, you have the depiction of the birth of the Christ. So the Christ child is born. So when this spiritual essence comes into this world that it's going to be living in. It finds itself born in this manger, surrounded by the animal nature. So it's symbolic. But at that same point, which is the point where humanity right now finds itself, is really the most critical point of this whole cycle, because there has been this descent and involvement in matter, this development of a separated self. Through that separated self, certain powers are experienced and called forth from this deeper dimension. But then an awareness takes place, as you say. I mean, your way of putting it was beautiful, that this self doesn't serve any purpose. When it comes to the point that someone has that as their focus, that this self has served its purpose, we find ourselves moving into this upward arc, which is what's described as the path of return. So the soul returning to the house of the Father is the way it's described sometimes, but bringing with it all of these capacities, all of these powers, and then all of these others that it brings with it on this path of return. So this is a grander cycle. When we find ourselves just looking at the self part of it, sometimes it can be a little confusing because we lose context. But you put it into this grander context, and it's something that not only has meaning, but it has really profound meaning.
There is one question through the internet, and it is, how does one, or how can one, counsel someone who is fear-based in any all their emotions? In all their emotions, fear-based.
Yeah, they're stuck in fear.
Yeah.
Fear can have, one of the characteristics of being fearful, oftentimes in some literature you'll read about clairvoyant descriptions of the person's aura, for instance, or the thought forms that are generated by someone who is in a state of perpetual fear. And it's a difficult emotion because it's very confining, very isolating. Always it's described as the color that is generated in the aura of the person is always of a grayish nature. And it can be something that kind of hardens the aura of the person, meaning essentially that the ordinary healthy individual, there's a natural flow of energies out and in. But when that is impeded, everything starts to come from inside of you only, and it gets distorted. So someone who has some sort of perpetual fear base, you know, about the only thing I think you can really do is to, sometimes you can expose someone to nature, for instance. Oftentimes the energetic patterns of the natural world are stable patterns. Most of us find ourselves living in urban situations these days. Most of the world is urban. And so what you find is that from moment to moment, you're in the presence of these very erratic, humanly produced energy patterns. And so even day and night lose their meaning. So nature can have a restorative aspect. And then too, you know, just the trying to understand what's the basis for the fear sometimes. If the person can actually point to it, that's something that can be give great relief in and of itself. So again, awareness through exposure to nature, awareness through the necessary work of looking and recognizing and naming what the fear might be, those are things that can empower.
I just wanted to suggest also that as a worker of the library, we have a wonderful book that maybe Brother Tim can tell us a little bit more about, written by one of our ex-presidents of the Theosophical Society in the Philippines, that is called The Process of Self-Transformation. Brother Tim, would you please speak a little bit about this, that this could be a very helpful tool for many of us. And it was created by one of our very founders, you know, not very founders, but very members of our society.
Yeah, that's she's talking about a book by Vikhal Chin, who has been here before and will be here again. He wrote a wonderful book on a process, and it's a, you know, it's a guided process that one can engage in that approaches such emotions as fear from the perspective of the idea is that every emotional response reflects an energy pattern. So there is a natural energy system in the body, but that sometimes these energies become stagnant and become localized. So rather than the normal flow that would occur, they become localized. So for instance, we tend to experience fear. Most people have some fear and they experience it in the pit of their stomach. So when fear arises, part of the method that is prescribed is to become aware of it as an energy sensation. And where is it that you're feeling it in the body? So you become aware of that. And then in that awareness, if you pay attention to it, you also become aware that it, if you look at it, it has a certain shape, it has a certain character. So it could be something that feels quite hard, it could be round, but that you link this with the breath. So, you know, this is a brief description. You'll go to the book if you're interested in this sort of thing. But the breath is really the source of the flow of chi energy, or what's described as prana. And so that this pranic force, this energy, is focused on this area. And you just watch it. And as you breathe, it might expand. It will probably move. And you just keep focusing on it until it has eventually left you. And that's what will happen. And so the way this process is involved, it's something that you can actually work with fears by calling them to mind, focusing the attention, watching it as it moves, and watching it dissipate. And that over time, he has worked with people who have had, you know, just deathly fear of snakes or other things, and in one, two sessions, have got to have the people get up and pick up a big anaconda that they couldn't have even thought about previously without being fearful. So it's a very effective method. I don't do it justice in my description now because it takes a little more time. But again, thanks for bringing that up.
There's one other question through the internet is, what is the role of karma and what part does it play in the path of return that you spoke about just in the previous few questions?
Well, I mean, obviously karma is one of those things that plays a role in everything. I mean, everything that we do relates to karma. So, you know, it necessarily has a role. Obviously, the sort of karmic impulses that we have put out during the course of our many, many lives affect us now. So, you know, from moment to moment, we're shaping it. I really don't know much more to say about it. Karma's involved in everything. It's one of those things that is good to try to understand, although it's impossible to understand the full dimensions of the interrelationships that come through karmic law and the exercise of our will from moment to moment.